January 27th marks the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau, the largest Nazi death camp. In 2005, the United Nations General Assembly designated this day as International Holocaust Remembrance Day. To honor the victims, we spoke with a survivor, Simon Winston, who was just a toddler at the start of World War II and lost both friends and family during the war. When the Germans invaded his native Poland, Simon, along with his family, fled their home in the city of Radziwiłłów and went into hiding. Simon's own father was able to save him, though not without terrible trial.
First thing they did, they ordered the local authorities to give them the names of 100 dangerous Jews, whatever that meant, and they took them to a field and shot them.
On the 15th of August, all Jews were ordered into the market square.
When they got there, that's 7,000 Jews, and when they got there, they were told to sit on the floor, on the ground, and then suddenly a group of about 20 SS machine gunners popped up, and they pointed their machine guns at us, and we thought they were going to kill us. People were crying and screaming and fainting, praying, and this continued for about 2 or 3 hours, and then after 2 or 3 hours, a car pulled up outside the square. A very high-ranking officer came out of the car, and he waved his arm, and the machine gunners put their machine guns away, and they left. We were then ordered to go back to our houses. When we got back to our houses, we found that they were empty. The Germans had stolen all our belongings, everything, including furniture, like tables, chairs, and beds, and also cookers. So we didn't even have anything to cook our meager rations of food that we managed to scratch from wherever.
Next came the building and transfer of the Jews into the ghetto.
It was guarded on the outside by German Nazis and guarded on the inside by Ukrainian Nazis, which we discovered who were much more vicious than the German Nazis. The ghetto was divided into two halves. There was Ghetto 1, where all the strong and healthy Jews went. About 1,000 of them. That included my mother and my father, thank goodness, because people who went to Ghetto 1, they were taken out to work to do slave labor about 8 to 12 hours a day. But at least when they came back, they were reasonably rewarded, not with money. Money was useless, with food. Enough food for my father to even go to Ghetto 2, and take some of his food to his parents, because people in Ghetto 2, about 5,000 of them, they weren't getting any food at all. They were being starved to death, and that was the intention.
Any hope that the Nazis would leave the Jews to fend for themselves behind the ghetto walls was soon dashed.
And when the it was actually on the 1st of July 1942, when there were just 2,000 Jews left in Ghetto 2, the Germans must have thought, well, they're not dying fast enough, so they gave them a push. They ordered all the 2,000 Jews into what my father names as Waldmann's Yard, which was a workyard next to the Grand Synagogue, the big synagogue. And there the men were separated from the women, and the men were then forced marched about 5 kilometres into a nearby forest. And when they got there, they found that there were two huge pits already dug there, covered in lime, and they ordered the men to take off their clothes, put them on a nice neat pile, and go and stand around the first pit, which they did. They were skeletal. They were like zombies. They did anything and everything that they were told to do. And when they got to the first pit and they stood around it, they were shot dead, and they fell into the pit. And very quickly, a group of Ukrainian soldiers buried them. They were then ordered to go down to Waldmann's Yard and fetch the women. And like the men, the women were also marched and ordered to go to this clearing in the forest. And when they got there, they were also told to take off their clothes and to put them in a nice neat pile and go and stand around the second pit. And they were also shot dead, and they fell into the pit. And they were very quickly covered over. So on that day, 2,000 innocent Jews were brutally murdered by the Nazis. Life in Ghetto 1 continued more or less as before, except that one thing was very noticeable. There were only about 500 of us left then, because a lot of people were sent out to work and they never came back. But also we'd heard that all the other towns and cities around were becoming Judenrein, that means Jew-free. All the Jews had been killed, and by that time we realized that they'd invented and created these extermination camps like Auschwitz and Belzec, and there were no Jews living in these towns, and it was going to be our turn to become Judenrein. In other words, they were going to liquidate the Ghetto 1. So people started to make plans to escape, including my father.
From the Nazi guard who let himself be bribed to let the family pass, to risking drowning in a swollen river, the family faced many harrowing chances in their flight from certain death.
And on one occasion I remember that my father told me to hide in this field, which he told me to do before, in the middle of some tall corn that was growing there. I crouched down and waited for him to come and fetch me. But after about half an hour, instead of my father coming, a group of Ukrainian soldiers found me there. And the first thing they said to me, "What's your name?" And I gave them a name. Not my real name, a Ukrainian name. And they said, "Where do you live?" And I said, I gave them an address. And they said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm playing hide and seek. I'm waiting for my friends to catch me." And they believed me and went off, which was another miracle. But the real miracle of that was that I was able to speak to them at all, because my native tongue was Polish. But my father had deliberately taught me and my brother and my mother little phrases in Ukrainian just in case a situation like that happened. It happened and it saved our lives.
Eventually, Simon made his way to a shelter prepared for Jews by a Polish farm family. Even there, the inhumanity of the Nazis' murderous designs reached them.
That was a cellar under a barn, and it was much more spacious. So my father was able to invite some friends and relatives to come and join us. And in the end, there were 10 to 12 people living in the cellar. Also, we could come out in the daytime because there were windows in the barn, and we could see if the Germans were coming. But one of the people that my father invited to this hiding place in the cellar was my mother's brother's wife. And when she came, she was pregnant. And she gave birth in the cellar, in hiding. And when she gave birth, the baby was screaming and screaming. And the farmer heard this, and he told us to get out, because he was frightened for his life and his family's life. And we had to make a terrible, terrible decision. The baby was suffocated. I don't know. I was very young. I remember something had happened like that. It was only recently, about 5 years ago, that her sister, this baby sister that was suffocated, told me about this. But anyway, it was a decision of Solomon that one had to make. I don't know how I would have reacted. I was still a very small child. But sadly, if she'd have waited just 3 more months before delivering the baby, we would have all been saved, because in about February 1945, the farmer opened the trapdoor of the cellar, and the sun was shining, and he said, "You're free." I didn't know what that meant. Freedom, the word was new to me. He said that the Germans have left. They've been pushed by the Russians, and they were now in retreat, and the Russians are back. And sure enough, that was the case. So we surfaced, and the farmer even said, "You can go back home now." Well, we tried to go back home, but there were Russians and Ukrainians living in our houses, and they weren't going to give up their homes for us. So we became refugees, and we actually were refugees for about 2 years, wandering from one refugee camp to another. DPs, we were called, displaced persons, so we lived in DP camps.
The immediate post-war years were filled with uncertainty until an unexpected family reunion.
Eventually, in 1947, my mother discovered that she had a brother who lived in England. He actually came to Britain in 1939 from Vienna in Austria. That's a different story. But then when he discovered that my mother was still alive, he did everything possible to bring us over to England quite successfully. So in 1947, we arrived in England, and Well, as they say, the rest is history.
For 13 years, as a volunteer at the Holocaust Centre in Nottinghamshire, England, Simon has been telling his story to generations born after the war. He tells the story of the center's founding by a Christian family, the Smiths, who were moved by an experience while on pilgrimage in the Holy Land.
It was formed by a Christian family called the Smiths. They actually have written a book. Stephen Smith has written a book called Making Memories, and it's well worth getting hold of that book and reading it because it's quite profound. But essentially, they went to, they would see all the churches and Bethlehem and Nazareth, etc. But then they ventured into a place called Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Center, which was already, which has always been available. And that's the a very profound place. And what they saw there moved them tremendously. And they wanted to learn a little bit more about the Holocaust, and they discovered that there was no source in Britain for it. There was no Holocaust centres at all, so they created their own. On their own farmstead and their own house where they lived, the family, and their own money. And it was a wonderful achievement. And then they invited people, particularly survivors, to come and tell their stories, which we have been doing ever since. I actually only discovered the place 13 years ago, 2 years after its creation. But what they have achieved and what they are actually doing is now, and they're working on a shoestring, really, and yet still they managed to get all this done because they are inviting schools to come and visit and see the exhibition, get a profound lesson in Holocaust education and World War II. Then the culmination is they get to hear a survivor speak, and I often speak there.
The Holocaust Center has expanded its work to include advocacy and education about the evil of genocide in the present day.
The Holocaust is now history, but genocide is still carrying on. It's still happening. And that's when they decided that, you know, we have to address the issue of genocide. So the whole place is buzzing with tremendous enthusiasm towards addressing the issue of genocide and particularly the Holocaust so that it's never forgotten.
Simon also told me of how the center is working to stop genocide before it starts.
The crucial element is that you have a starting point for the Holocaust and for genocide, and that's prejudice. Because if you don't deal with it properly, prejudice leads to abuse, and that's the abuse of power, like bad leaders like Hitler, and the abuse of the law, bad leaders who make bad laws. And then if you don't stop that, you have ethnic cleansing. You get rid of people that you don't like in your own country, and if you can't get rid of them, you kill them, and that's called genocide. So there's like a paradigm of how it starts. And children have to be taught. And then when they come to the Holocaust Center, which, and by the way, that the Holocaust Center and perhaps even, well, certainly the Smiths were very instrumental in making sure that Holocaust education is now part of the curriculum. So whereas before they might have just brushed over it in World War II history in their curriculum, it's now a very essential part of the curriculum. So when they come to the centre, a place like the Holocaust Centre, they get an overview of what actually did happen. And then eventually they finish up with an hour's talk by one of the survivors. And there are about 50 survivors who come on a regular basis to give them their story. And they do it in a very, very passionate way so that the children are immersed in this whole problem. During World War II, it wasn't just a case of a war and people fighting one against the other. It was that horrible way in which a certain group of people, the Nazis, were able to coerce and force other people to act in most inhuman ways. And the effect of that was the death of 10 million people during the Holocaust.